Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Yes, I think it's a hopeful book. It's a book full of hope for me. It was, I wrote a much darker book, which could be The Dark Side of Compass, called Zone, a few years ago, 10 years ago. But now, for me, Compass was a way to try to find a new hope, precisely through cultural exchange, through knowledge, and through desire. And I think the mixing knowledge and desire is how we can maybe get some new hope into the future.
Once more, I try to close my eyes, yet my heart beats strong and warm. When will the leaves at my window turn green? When will I hold my darling in my arms? The melancholy words of Austrian composer Franz Schubert from his iconic poetic song cycle, The Winterreise, which opens French novelist Mathieu Senard's latest book, Compass, published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What is Orientalism? And how and why did so many scholars, anthropologists and intellectuals throughout history present a romanticised and somewhat distorted view of the East? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle those questions with French novelist, translator and scholar Mathieu Senard, whose latest book, Compass, offers the reader a unique and lively study on the complex intersections between East and West. So let's hear from Mathieu Senard.
Hello, my name is Mathieu Senard. I'm a writer. I've written like 8 or 10 novels. 5 of them have been translated into English, and the last one is Compass. And Compass is a story of a love and desire and knowledge. It's the story of Franz Ritter, an Orientalist, a specialist of music and musicology, who is desperate in love with another scholar called Sarah. And through the all night, a very long night, he recalls not only his relationship with Sarah, but also the travels he had with her in Syria, Istanbul, Iran. And through that, the story of our relationship, of Europe's relationship with the East and the Middle East.
Really well done on the book, Mathieu. So I have to say it was a hugely stimulating read, expansive, so incredibly interesting. And you you offer so many different cultural references, geographical references throughout the book. It has such a dreamlike quality. It's intense. I loved every bit of it. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off and sure we can take it from there. How fluid is culture, do you think?
It flows through. For me, culture is all about desire. It's the urge you have to know something, the desire you have to get to know more. So culture is something we share between us, like music in the air, or phrases, quotes from a book, or a verse of poetry, like a flavor. Something really, somehow, it has to be shared and also desired. So that's why the book is always between desire between France and Sarah, but also the desire we have for knowledge and the need we have to get to know more about each other. And that's for me what culture is.
France, our narrator, is pining for his great love, Sarah, and He's very much possessed by it, and he's searching through his memories, and he's very emotionally in a very disruptive state. I'm just wondering, how intense was it for you to write a character like France, and how much of yourself did you bring into it?
It was really interesting because, I share many things with France. We share, for example, travels. I lived in Syria too. I've lived in Syria for years. In Iran, so we share places with France. I know Vienna very well. So once we share with Rome, there's common places, common books, histories. But I am not Franz Ritter. I mean, it's not autobiographical. So I changed a lot of things from what I personally lived. But I used a kind of energy and my own lust for knowledge and interest for languages and foreign cultures, probably.
You speak fluent Arabic, is that right?
That's right. Yes, I learned Arabic first at the university and then I had the chance to live a long time in Syria and Lebanon and work there too.
And when you look at some of the challenges facing the Middle East and specifically Syria, it must break your heart, does it? Because the country is absolutely destroyed at this stage.
It is really, for me it's really terrible. Because, you know, the last time I was in Syria was short before the events. That means that was 2011, something like that. And I had many, many friends in Syria, which, well, all of them now are either dead or exiled in Europe or in the Arab world or the Arab countries. So it's terrible to see how a country can collapse and destroy itself. It's really something hard to believe, to see that whole cities are now only dust and ruins. But more important than that the people who made these cities real and live are now either dead all the way. And so it's very sad.
So what was the big question you set out to tackle when you were starting to research Compass? Because you cover a lot of ground in the book and you're clearly interrogating issues related to Orientalism. So I'm just wondering, what did you want to get at?
Well, at first it was not really... at first I began to write that book before the events in Syria began, but during the 4 or 5 years that lasted the writing, the events were always in the backyard, like popping up in my computer through the news. So the war was always there behind what I was writing. And I have always been interested in the issue of Orientalism, maybe because I myself have studied Arabic and Persian. So it's something you have to take into account when you're planning to, or you're just researching those languages and countries and literatures. And there's something really fascinating about the story of our relationships with the east and southern part of the Mediterranean Sea, that is the Ottoman Empire first, and then Iran and all those lands. We have shared a very long history of in terms of domination, cultural and political, economical domination, and Orientalism is a part of it. So I wanted to explore those grounds and see what in the 21st century was left of these adventures and the long, very long story of Europe trying to dominate the East and the Middle East in particular.
Do you think it's fair to argue that Europeans have always come at the Middle East from this highly Eurocentric point of view, that they have tried to understand and shape and, I suppose, live with and live through the Orient from their own perspectives, from their own judgments, using their own frameworks, if you will?
Yes, partly. But you know what, the main point was that in the 18th century, at the end of the 18th century, in the beginning of the 19th century, this relationship changed, and the aim with the entering of the military into the Middle East, the first expedition was Napoleon Bonaparte in Egypt in 1798, you know. It was very... Then Europe had this part military, part cultural adventure that was that the war and warfare was always going on with, let's say, cultural side in it. That was Orientalism. For example, when Bonaparte gets into Egypt, he takes with him a lot of scholars to study civilization and what was left of the pharaohs, or on the whole story of Egypt, not only in the old antique Nile Valley ruins, but also the contemporary Egypt they discovered at that time. So Orientalism is always a part of a much bigger enterprise of colonization, and that goes for the whole 19th century and the beginning of the 20th.
Both Francois narrator and his love interest, Sarah, they're constantly translating the East. And what I mean by that is they're, you know, philosophically translating, they're culturally translating, psychologically translating all aspects of the Middle East. And it got me thinking that in a lot of ways, we're all translating all through our human experiences, through our relationships, whether we're in our country of origin or whether we move to, let's say, the Middle East. We're all in that state of translation.
Yes, that's right. That's really interesting. You know, they are also translating between each other because Sarah is French and Francois is a Viennese, Austrian. He speaks German. Let's say that his mother tongue is German, even if he speaks fluently French. So, yes, it's true. I think that translation is the most universal kind of language we share. We translate for ourselves first, even without traveling a lot, we have to adapt ourselves through language to other people, even if it remains in the frame of the same tongue, let's say. But to live is a kind of translation of between day-to-day life and our dreams and all the now, furthermore, now in the 21st century, in our globalized world, we get to see and hear and meet many, many languages from all over the world. And I think translation is one of the main issues of the 21st century and will remain so.
And we're translating consciously and unconsciously, and then within that, bringing in all our prejudices and biases. But I suppose that's what makes life so interesting.
In a way, we are like bringing it all back home, you know. Everything it's very difficult to forget ourselves and to be really, to meet the other and to find what is the other inside us and to discover what we share with the other. Normally translation is also a very selfish act, in a way, which which erases the otherness and make it into the self.
I presume you're a big fan of classical music, are you? Because Francois, our narrator, has quite a philosophy on the history of music. He's quite an opinion on the likes of Schubert, Liszt, Berlioz, Bizet, Beethoven. And he feels that, you know, they've borrowed a lot, or possibly watered down, if it's not too strong to say, Middle Eastern music through their own compositions. What's your own view of that? Because it's a very interesting pitch.
Oh, yes, I am a big classical music fan. I learned a lot writing this book because precisely what I wanted to write about, with this, let's say, musical orientalism, we don't really know, or we've forgotten in Europe. But it was really important also for the musicians, not only the painters or the writers, to discover, let's say, the music of the other, to change their own European compositions. Just an example, for example, when Berlioz in Paris goes to a concert of a now forgotten musician called Félicien David, who has written a very, very strange piece of music about the desert in Egypt, when you can hear the first prayer, Muslim prayer call, the Azan, in, let's say, sung by a European tenor. So you hear the Allahu Akbar and the call to the prayer, but in the frame of a very European classical music orchestra, you know, like a symphonic orchestra with a tenor singer singing this Muslim call to the prayer. And Darius hears that and he notices that this tune uses very small tones, smaller than a half tone, than quarter tones that now we know are very typical and traditional of Arabic music. But at that time, they didn't know that. So for Darius, it's really a discovery to hear that. And this color of sound, he will later use to change his own symphonical colors of his composition. So for him, it's really a very important discovery. He quotes the next morning in his review for a very important Paris newspaper that what he has heard is yet unheard in Paris. You know, it's very, very new for him. So these relationships were quite forgotten and only known to scholars and specialists of that field. So I was very happy when I read that and discovered it was all this world waiting to be listened to again.
It's a lovely idea, but I suppose when you think about it, Sasha, you know, all musicians are borrowing from other musicians. They're all in relationship. They're all in conversation. When you go into any, you know, art gallery, you go into any space, performance, whatever it is, there is always a part of something else running through. There's nothing absolutely unique. Sure, there's not.
No, but what happened at that time was that there was the whole world of European art was opening to the southern side of the Mediterranean and the eastern side of the Mediterranean. So it was quite a very important moment that, let's call it, the Romantic Revolution or something like that, that changes totally the form, the shape, the sound of art at that time. I mean, literature, poetry, music, and the encounter with the East was very important to that revolution, either in poetry or in music or in painting. The possibility to travel, to listen, or to read other forms of verses, melodies, tunes, anything, was very, very important to that change.
Matthias, you must have spent ages putting together the research for the book, because I don't think I've ever read a book with so many geographical, historical, cultural references, and some of them are quite scholarly references. So I'm just wondering, in terms of the research, was it a case of you got stuck in and then the whole area just expanded and expanded, or how did you go about it all? Because there's so much in it.
Yes. What was really complex, rather than the research in itself, was how to map the book and how to design it in very novestical way with the plots and characters, not to make it just an essay, but really put all those elements, all those, let's say, cultural or scholarly elements into action, and to make really a novel of deception and desire, to compose a novel of deception and desire with all these elements. That was one was tough. But the research in itself, you know, I'm in another life, I was a scholar, let's say. I know how to research and to use databases and to build a bibliography and all those kind of things. So that was not the point for me. But the point was really, what was really interesting, it was to build characters like Franz and Sarah, who themselves are scholars, and they're in love, so, but they don't do like us. They don't send roses or chocolate boxes. They give themselves books and references and old forgotten songs. You know, that's how they, that's their strange way to make love, in a sense.
As I said, it's a very intense read, and it's set over one night. And, you know, France is in quite a state. He's very distracted. He's, you know, he's almost convulsing in parts. And he's you know, he's tettering on the brink of something major. He's almost, it feels like you're reading through an emotional collapse. And within that, we get so much shame and we get so much regret. Was that something that you really wanted to interrogate?
Yes, probably. You know, a writer can be a kind of entomologist at the time. And France is my insect. I have him there for me the whole night. And I observe him in pain. I observe him in despair, in melancholy, but also in happy remembrance of the past. So when you get so deep into a character, there's always a kind of... it's like exploring some very foreign lands. You discover new emotions. You see something you didn't expect. And France was a very interesting character. He was he thinks himself as sick, very sick. He thinks himself is on the edge of death. But we don't know if it's really true. Maybe it's just overreacting to some bad medical news he had. So I was then exploring some, very strange feelings, new to me, you know. And so it was quite fun being friends for a few years.
Would you describe yourself as romantic, would you, Matthias?
In the historical sense, no, not really. No, romantic. Well, like anyone else, I think I enjoy some romance, and I also like the old German romantic poetry, or music, some kind of every kind of music. But I'm not so sure I'm romantic. I'm much more, you know, a writer cannot. In those days, it's difficult to be really romantic, as you write. The world is too dark and too painful at times.
You bring up some extraordinary historical figures in the book, and one lady that I particularly enjoyed reading about was Lady Hester Stanhope.
Yes.
And how you introduce the different characters in from history, and they flow into each other so easily. And I imagine that must have been very difficult to do, because it all flows and intersects in different creative ways. But to actually accomplish that as a writer must have been very difficult. But can you tell me about Lady Hester Stanhope? Because her backstory is quite something, isn't it?
Yes, Lady Hester is this really fascinating character. She has a... and also many links with Middle Eastern and European travellers who visited her. She settled in the Middle East, exactly in the Lebanon. She settled in the Lebanese mountain of the Shouf, and had there an estate with the peasants and fields, and ruled them as she was the lord of a small village. And for a woman at that time, of course, it was very surprising, not only for the natives, but also for the Europeans who visited her. And we have a very interesting account, a visit of the French poet Lamartine to her in Lebanon, and he calls her the Circe of the deserts, and he sees her as a magician, as a very, very strong character and a very strong figure, which she was, actually.
Do you think the Lebanon still holds the same charm and mystery as it would have in history? You know, I've travelled all across the Lebanon, and it's an exquisite country in a lot of different ways, but it's facing a lot of challenges. But I'm just wondering, what's your own view?
For me, the Lebanon is still fascinating. Probably not in the same way. Though you still have this wonderful valleys and breathtaking sights and astonishing people. But it's true that it faces very, very difficult challenges those days, especially with what's happening in Syria. You know, it's a country surrounded by war, who experienced the 20-year civil war itself. So it's always on the edge of violence and warfare. But until now, it holds, and it's holding fast. So let's hope and cross fingers that it remains so.
Its music is extraordinarily beautiful, though, isn't it? Lebanese music.
Yes, Lebanese music, as it's all over its music. Lebanon, you know, is part of the Arab world with many, many influences and many cultural and musical influences from the old Orthodox liturgy music until the music of the desert, for example, and the very Arabic music of the cities from the Abbasid times, for example. So it's really a mix of all these influences. And in the 20th century, a very strong Western influence, let's say. So it has one of the most interesting modern music scene in the Arab world nowadays, Beirut.
You look at aspects of Sufi mysticism in the book and, you know, you look at, you know, Sufi thought, sexuality and so on. And I'm just wondering, do you think certain aspects of Sufism have been misunderstood, certainly in the West?
By whom? Misunderstood, maybe not, but maybe underestimated. Okay. We tend to see Islam and the religious reality in the Muslim world from Morocco to India as it was something unified and unique, you know. But we don't see the small local differences first, and then the big differences there are now between a more globalized Salafist Islam and more local, discreet, but very important mystical tariqas, for example. So it's not that it doesn't exist, it's just that we don't see it because it's not so so present in the news and so important to us from seen from here.
And in the writing of Compass, I presumed that stretched your understandings of Sufism. Like, clearly you speak Arabic, you've translated Arabic texts, and you spent a lot of time in the Middle East. But presumably by going in and in the research of this book, it stretched you a little bit further, did it?
Oh, yes. That's always what's really interesting in writing, is that you get to learn very much. And you get to share things that you've learned with the readers. So if you can maybe get something to know better yourself, then you can share it with others and try to communicate your passion for something. And I have a real passion for the Middle East, the Arab world, or Iran, and the Persian literature, for example. So it was for me very, very important to communicate this passion with others and with readers and to let them know something probably they didn't know and make it available to them in an easier form.
Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with French novelist, translator and scholar Matthias Enhardt about his latest book, Compass, published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. I asked Matthias about the intellectual contribution of Edward Said to our understandings of East-West relations and whether he stretched things a bit.
He's very important. He's one of the key scholars of this field because he asked very important questions about our field and our knowledge and how what we know about the East is a part of a colonial knowledge. And asking this question in his book called Orientalism, which he published in 76 or 77, if I'm not mistaken, this was like 40 years ago, it is still one of the most important scholars in that field. Because he's the one who's asked first this question, how can knowledge be a part of a cultural and economical domination plan, and how Europe, especially France and Great Britain, tried to dominate the East, not only in a military or economical way, but also through cultural knowledge. And doing that, how they somehow stole from the East the possibility of its own cultural independence. That's what Said exposes and asks in his book, Orientalism. And it is a very important question nowadays, too. Of course, 40 years later, we know more about Orientalism. We have researched more, and there are many scholars who have interested themselves for this field after Said. But still, he remains the starting point and is very important.
And do you think, to some degree, your book is in conversation with some of his thoughts, do you think? Or you're in response to some of the questions that he brought up?
Oh, I'd love to. No, you know, I am a very fan of Said. And, you know, Said was also a great musicologist himself. He played the piano very well, and he has written about music. And he, yes, it's a kind of conversation with him. I mean, France, my character, would love to have the opportunity to talk with Edouard Said. And I think he was a very fascinating writer and fascinating scholar. And much more diverse than we think now. He has written about, for example, had very, very interesting articles about literature, but also about music, about his reflections on exile, what exile means, and his life itself was very interesting and was the, also the matter for one of his best books. So no, Said is definitely one of my masters.
Can I ask you, Matthias, at the start of the book and then in your acknowledgements, you reference a seminal research paper, which is pretty heavy-duty stuff, I might add, on endocannibalism by Peter Metcalfe. I think it's called The Wine of the Corpse. I didn't know much about that, so I looked it up on the internet. And bloody hell, it's extraordinary dark, isn't it?
It's dark, indeed, but also full of life. You know, this the main, you know, it's an article, very serious article about Sarawak and the north coast of the Bali Islands. And it is, so it's Malaysia. And it's about an ethnia called the Balawan, who have and their ritual of death. And the wine of the corpse is not real, because, you know, it's a symbolic function of what happens to a body after death. And this tribe in particular think that death is not a moment. It's a process. So it's not died, you know. It's life escaping slowly from a body through a kind of horrible wine. Horrible for us, but for them, it's the way of seeing the passage from life to death. So this article, if I quote it, it's because it was really important for me. And maybe at the end, in the final draft of the book, it might seem something, not so important, but for me it was, because it was like the starting point of the research for Compass.
Matthias, Compass came out in French first, and then it was translated into English by the American literary translator Charlotte Mandel. Yes. I know that you worked with her also on your book Zone and also on Street of Thieves. Yes. Trust must be an amazing part of that relationship. You must be very close, are you, for her to be able to, you know, it's a difficult text. It's not straightforward. And within the narrative, there's so many different things going on. So you must have, to trust somebody to actually get what you were getting at must have been quite something, was it?
Yes. And you know, translation is something very complex. And I know that because I'm a translator myself from other languages. So I have huge respect for Charlotte Mandel. She's a wonderful translator, and it's very pleasant to work with her. We are, even if she lives in New York, well, up New York State, so we are constantly mailing each other or texting each other. So we are very close when we are into the translating process. And we trust. I trust her with my text. So, at times she asks me if I prefer this or that version, and when she has a doubt. But I completely trust her. So, it's a wonderful relationship we have. Yes.
And how does the whole dynamic work in terms of the actual translating? Does she send you drafts? You review? What way does it work?
Well, first of all, she translates like the whole first version of the text, and then she asks me during the process of translation. She asks me, for example, if there's something she's not sure she's understood well, or something she doesn't find, like a reference, or so she asks me. Then I answer, of course, and then at the end, when she has her first draft, she sends it to me, and I read it and I just applaud and say it's perfect, and then she she works at it again, and then we're done.
Presumably, she spends so much time with your books, she understands, she goes into it. In some way, within that collaborative process, are there different emphases, different nuances? Do you see or feel a difference between the two?
Yes, of course. To read oneself in another language is always a challenge. It's something very strange because you recognize yourself, but like seen through a very deforming mirror, you know. It's because, of course, it's your text, but it's in English, or it's in German, or it's in Spanish, or it's in Arabic. So you know what you have written, and if you know English or German, then you can read it, but it's not you. It's someone else writing in another language what you have written first. So it's a very interesting way to get the distance with your own text. You read it almost as if it wasn't you, but you recognize yourself in the reflexes somewhere. And yes, it's very, very strange experience. I remember the first time I read myself in translation, that was must have been like 10 years ago or 12, and it felt like something. I was not myself anymore, you know. Suddenly I was American, or suddenly I was German or Japanese, you know. So it was fun, but also frightening at times.
Did you find that a bit creepy?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yes, it's you know, it's this possibility to have the world that translates you into 300-something languages and, like, so many reflexes and reflections of yourself. You don't really know where you are, really. So you have to go back to the French text to really know where you are and what you've written.
Tell me, Matthias, Compass has won a range of awards and been shortlisted for several very high-profile awards, including the Man Booker International Prize. But you won the Concours Prize in France in 2015. That must have been quite something. Were you surprised with all the attention the book got? Because it's not exactly a mainstream read.
I was not surprised by the attention the book got. I was surprised by the success it was. Because, you know, it's not an easy read. That's what I discovered afterwards. For me, I wrote it to be something easy to read. I wrote it to be... I wrote it to be read by everyone. But I discovered that it was not so easy to read for everyone. So I was quite surprised by the international audience it got. And it was a big success also in Germany. In Austria, in all those countries, was shortlisted for the International Man Booker. I won a prize in Italy. So I realized that it was not only a French issue, or that all the Europeans had this interest for the East and to know more about our relationships with the East. So that was my discovery of through the success of the book. And I was very happy about that.
It certainly is a very active read, and it demands a lot of the reader because you're constantly sifting through different references and wondering. But what it really does is it makes you question your own relationships with the other, or different cultures, or how you go about understanding different cultures, and whether we're all equals or not. And I think that has to be a really good thing.
Oh, yes, for me, it is indeed a really good thing that we question our hegemony in a way. We see that we owe a lot to the other, that we have always exchanged through, I don't know, all the centuries of our history with the south and the east of the Mediterranean Sea, that we are much more globalized from the beginning than we think, and that our cultures are mixed cultures, that there's nothing like a pure self or a pure identity, that we are also kind of a global, very slow mixture of cultures and cultural influences. And that's the beauty of it. It's like the diversity of, you know, now it's very, we talk a lot about that, about biodiversity and how we should interest ourselves more for bees and plants and protect them. But, you know, we are the kind of image of the nature. It means we are also much more diverse than we think. And our language, our cultures are a part of this universal diversity and mixity. And that's very important to know and to preserve.
So what's the hope with the book, Matthias? Because, you know, it's been translated now, it's been listed on all these high-profile awards and so on, so that brings you to a greater audience. But I'm wondering, what is your wish with the book? Because France, in a lot of ways, is a very hopeful character, although he's plagued by his love situation and he's very frustrated. But there is a lot of hope running through the book.
Yes, I think it's a hopeful book. It's a book full of hope. For me, it was... you know, I wrote a much darker book, which could be The Dark Side of Compass, called Zone, a few years ago, 10 years ago. But now I am, for me, Compass was a way to try to find a new hope, precisely through cultural exchange, through knowledge, and through desire. And I think the mixture, mixing knowledge and desire, is how we can maybe get some new hope into the future.
That was French novelist and translator Mathias Ennard. Compass is published by Fitzcarraldo Editions and retails for just under €16 in paperback. Now, I have to say hats off to Mathias. This is one hell of a book. It's expansive, multi-layered, and makes for a wonderfully immersive read. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say thank you for listening and a big shout out to the lovely Jojo on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to close tonight's broadcast with the heroic words of Persian poet, theologian and Sufi mystic Rumi, who once quipped, "Gamble everything for love. If not, leave this gathering. Half-heartedness doesn't reach into majesty." How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.